Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. When it comes to politics, the news cycle is running fast and furious. We've seen unexpected changes at the top of the Democratic presidential ticket, and Republicans are having to switch gears quickly as poll numbers appear to be changing. With the Democratic convention in the rearview mirror, we check in with two congressional reporters to get the inside scoop on how members of Congress are reacting to all of this, what the polls are saying, and more. That's later in the program. First, though, earlier this month, we spent the first half of this program speaking with North Carolina's 12th District Congresswoman Alma Adams about goings-on in D.C. and on the campaign trail. She has a Republican challenger in that race, Abdul Ali, and in the interest of fairness, we will spend an equal amount of time with him this hour. He has served as both chairman of the Cabarrus County Republican Party and is co-founder of the Urban Conservative, the focus of which is to share conservative values and principles in urban areas across the country. And Mr. Ali joins us now. Welcome back to the program. I should mention that you just informed me that you were here many years ago as part of our series of Average Joe programs.
Yes, thanks, sir. For coming back. Honored to be back. Honored to be back with you. Yes, sir.
Well, nice to have you here. Last time you were just an average Joe. Now you're running for Congress. So you're a Republican running in a predominantly a Democratic district against a long-serving Democratic congresswoman who has been in office since 2014. Do you think you have a shot?
Absolutely. And the reason I think we have a shot is because as I've been out on the campaign trail talking to unaffiliated voters and Democrat voters, it's becoming clear to me that people want something different. They want a different approach to the happenings in D.C. And so, yeah, I think that, and especially in a cycle like this, anything is possible.
So you've done a lot of things over your career. I just scratched the surface a moment ago. So tell voters a little bit about yourself, why you want this job.
Well, first and foremost, to the listeners, I am a working class guy. I've towed trucks for the last 20 years. I've run a small business. My twin brother and I run a small business. I'm invested in this city. My children were born and raised here. I had the honor of serving in the United States Army. So as patriotic as they come. And I think that it's about time that the approach that we take in Washington, D.C. has changed. When you have career politicians who've been in office for, 20, 30 years in government, you kind of exist in a bubble. And I think that we've got to start looking at the solutions differently for the issues that are facing our city here. And our campaign is really focused on the things that the voters of this city, both unaffiliated Democrat and Republican voters, have told us, which is improving our early childhood literacy. As we all know, our children are coming out of school in large part functionally illiterate. We're talking about upward economic mobility. And while we've made some strides in that, now we're only 38 out of 50 major cities, but I think we can do better. And I think it takes somebody with a business mindset and a fix-it mindset to work on that. And last but not least, we all know that, property crime and crime, our homicide rate is getting out of control. We need to stem the flow of fentanyl coming across the southern border to provide safety and security for our community. And those are the three things that I think the voters of Charlotte, both Democrat, unaffiliated voters, want their congressperson to be tackling.
And I don't disagree with you. You just mentioned literacy. You also are a proponent of working on improving upward mobility, which we will talk about as we go through here. But one of the building blocks of upward mobility is literacy. You got to read or you can't get anywhere in this world. But Republicans in Congress and President Trump running for re-election would like to end the Department of Education. So if they are successful, are you on board with that? And if they are successful with that, you will have no say over how schools are operated. So it kind of neuters your push toward literacy, doesn't it?
Well, I think that when you look at the budget of the Federal Department of Education being over $200 billion, have we seen the return on the investment of better literacy outcomes for our children? And I would argue that we haven't. I think we need to really take a hard and fast look at how efficient these organizations are and where we need to cut the fat. We need to cut the fat. But I think that the state governments and local people who are working to improve the literacy outcomes of our children would be better served getting those dollars than bureaucrats and politicians.
You're originally, you mentioned that your kids were born and raised here, but you are originally from New York City, and you've described yourself as a city guy who never really experienced the great outdoors prior to your military service, in which they made you sleep outside for the first time in your life. You had been a runaway as a teen. You've experienced homelessness prior to serving. And I'm just curious how that informs who you are today and how that helps you bring something new to the table as a potential candidate for Congress.
Well, look, we all know what our young people are facing in this city. We all know that, you know, upwards of 75% of our young people are being born into single parent households, be that single mom or single dad households. And for me, that experience of growing up in the social service system, growing up the way that I did, separated from my twin brother, surviving domestic violence and substance abuse, it is at the core of why I want to serve, and at the core of why I believe that I'm the best person to do this job, is because I know what folks are going through. And if I might just say something, you know, the reality of this is far too many of our young people are experiencing the things that I've experienced growing up. And I think we need people in Congress who have had those experiences and will know how to work effectively to solve some of those issues and empower people to do better. So it's at the very core, Mike, of who I am.
You've been a longtime Republican. As I said, you chaired the Cabarrus County Republican Party for a while. Why? Why did you choose the Republican Party to align yourself with?
Well, I consider myself an urban conservative in that I'm an urban guy. I live in a city. I grew up that way. But when I did an analysis of the two party platforms, I had to really find out what my values are and where I landed on the scale. And when we talk about the ideas of a small, effective, and efficient government, allowing the American citizens to keep more of their hard-earned money, when we talk about the importance of faith, family, and freedom, those were things that resonated with me. And I also, in my beginnings, I sat down with the Democratic Party. I talked with those folks. I sat down with Republicans. And what really pushed me over the edge, as it were, was when I read the autobiography of Frederick Douglass. So I style myself, when we talk about Republicanism, as more of a Frederick Douglass-style Republican, where I think we need to be focusing on the things that will allow people to truly enjoy the freedom that this country affords. So it was really what I will call an analysis of the party platforms and a real deep internal dive into where my values lied. And I think that for me personally, just looking at the party platforms was the way that I would identify which party I was going to go with.
So that's faith, family, and freedom, which you just mentioned, sounds very much like everything they talked about at the Democratic National Convention recently. And I know you made this decision about which party you wanted to affiliate yourself with many years ago, when perhaps things were different. Things have changed in the era of Donald Trump. Here's a guy, you're a veteran who has disparaged veterans and those serving time in the military, doesn't like people who have been captured, doesn't want to go to the graves of veterans. He thinks that they're suckers. He doesn't exactly align either, it seems to me, with your Christian beliefs. Has the party changed from under you?
Oh, Mike, I'm going to push back a little bit. 19 people that were at that event said that Donald Trump did not say such a thing. And the other day, it was Donald Trump that was at the grave celebrating the lives of those 13 people that were lost.
Yes, and filming a commercial, which is illegal.
I mean, I don't agree with that. If he was doing that, I don't agree with that. And anybody, whether it's Donald Trump, I'm not such a part of the fan, a cult of personality, where if you disparage our veterans for their service, I'm going to disagree with that. I didn't like the comments he made about John McCain, so I'll agree with you there. I wasn't a fan of those. But I think that when we talk about somebody who really respects, and I know a lot of folks who have served under Donald Trump, he cares about our veterans. But again, I think that any disparaging remarks, whether that be against John McCain or anybody, I condemn those remarks. I wouldn't agree with that.
Where do you stand on the outcome of the 2020 election?
Joe Biden became the president. I mean, It's to me, it's a non-issue. We need to be talking about 2024. And look, were there anomalies in the election? Absolutely. Have people gone to jail on both sides for voter fraud? Absolutely. I think voter ID is important, and that's one of the best ways to secure our elections. Unfortunately, we have people in Congress that want to vote against that kind of thing, but I think that's the best way to secure our election, have an ID.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but you have described your opponent, Alma Adams, and President Biden both as deep state politicians. If that is correct, what does that mean?
So what I meant by that is these are lifelong career politicians who have been in government for over 30 years. Combined, they've been in government for over 75 years. And that's what I meant by that. I think once you, and I said this before, once you've been in government so long, you don't know what the average person is going through because you've been in that government bubble for so long. And that's what I was alluding to. These are folks that are entrenched in the government bureaucracy that's in place. And I think that it's time, and the voters that I'm hearing are saying it's time for some fresh blood, some new ideas, and people who want to approach the problems facing our country in a different way.
We're talking to Adil Ali, who is running for Congress in the 12th District as a Republican. You say that you embrace conservative principles and values. Describe them for me. What are they?
So I think at the heart of conservatism is to conserve. And most people in their day-to-day lives do little things that could be ascribed as conservative, like putting a little water, extra water in the ketchup to stretch that out. And for me, conservative values mean conserving the things that make this country great. Things like open debate, things like support for our military, things like law and order. So when we talk about the urban part of the urban conservative, in my mind, I'm talking about the things that made our country better, like the government not being in people's hospital rooms, the government not being in people's bedrooms, and focusing on the things that government needs to focus on.
Well, why do you align yourself with a party that wants to do precisely that and is in fact doing it?
Well, I heard on the interview, and it's interesting to me that people say, you know, Donald Trump has made a clear statement on abortion. It's back to the states. And then we say, well, they secretly want to do a nationwide ban. I've not met one Republican that wants to enforce a nationwide ban on abortion. Most of the folks I've talked to are happy where it's at the states. And quite frankly, just because somebody aligns with a political party doesn't mean they're going to agree 100% with everything that party's leadership does. And if I might, I follow what I call the 20-20-60 rule. I think 20% of the people in party and leadership are far, far left. You've got 20% that's far, far right. And most Americans that I've talked to, and at least in my philosophy, that 60% of us are right dead smack in the middle, slightly right, slightly left, depending on the issue. So, you know, again, although I'm a Republican, I don't have to agree with everything that the party does. And to those extreme positions, those people that want to ban abortion, because there are, let's admit it, Republicans that would, if they had the power, completely ban abortion, that's not reality. The reality of it is, I have a daughter, and if my daughter had an ectopic pregnancy, or my daughter was never going to be an option in my household, was the victim of incest, or my daughter was raped, I would want her to have access to that procedure. And I'm of the class where Democrats and Republicans used to say abortion should be rare, safe, and legal. And I think that's where we need to get back to in our politics.
But I'm not sure that you would be successful in that. Even if you got to Congress, you would tip the majority in the House, or help tip the majority in the House, or keep the majority in the House on the Republican side. And Republicans, of course, want to take the Senate. And if Donald Trump gets to the White House, there is this thing called Project 2025, which spells it out. They want to end abortion everywhere. And there are a lot of Republicans in Congress who would like to do it as well. And you might be the outlier.
Sure. And I think, look, I've read Project 2025. There are some way out things in there. Fortunately, they're not in a position to really affect any policy. So, you know, the other thing that I think that we have to be mindful of, especially about this Project 2025 thing, is it's been used as this political boogeyman, in my opinion, to scare people. Meanwhile, there are things in there that I agree with, like pro-fatherhood messaging and things of that nature, ensuring that we're shoring up our HBCU. So I'm not a fan of it in its entirety, and I don't think it should be policy.
I want to come back and talk more with you about some of your other ideas about pushing upward mobility, making it easier for people to achieve term limits, and some other things as well. We're talking to Adil Ali. He's running for Congress in North Carolina's 12th Congressional District, and we're coming right back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest this part of the program is Abdul Ali. He is the co-founder of the Urban Conservative, former chair of the Cabarrus County Republican Party, and a candidate for Congress against Alma Adams, the incumbent in North Carolina's 12th district, running obviously as a Republican. And I should also mention, like most people in America today, he also has a podcast. You have written about the importance of breaking down partisan barriers and creating opportunities in collaboration between Republicans and Democrats. Should you win this election, you will find yourself in a body where those barriers have only gotten stronger in the last couple of years, and where compromise would likely get you labeled as a rhino, Republican in name only. How would you deal with that?
First of all, look, people, one of the first things I heard in politics is that you're never going to make everybody happy. And to that point, okay, you call me a rhino, but the question is going to be, are we getting the work of the American people done? And am I doing the best for the people of the 12th congressional district that I can possibly do? And I'll go to sleep very well at night knowing that I've represented the people of the 12th congressional district, whether they're Democrat, unaffiliated, Republican, to the best of my ability.
But is that what's happening among members of your party in Congress? It seems to be that most of them, particularly the people on the right who are pulling the strings in the House of Representatives, are very focused on getting their agenda achieved. Constituency be damned.
Well, I think that's the unfortunate reality of the system of government, how we've arrived at where we are now in our government on both sides of the aisle. I think that when you have people who have been, and we talked about this before, been in government so long, it becomes less about the people you're serving and more about the retaining of your own power. And to that end, I hear people on both sides of the aisle talking about this uniparty. It's this idea that the people in power want to stay in power regardless. And I think that ideally, the work of the American people should be done across the aisle. And Mike, I'll be 46 this year. Since I've announced for this, I've had to kind of think back about my youth. I couldn't tell the difference growing up between Democrats and Republicans. They would all say the same thing pretty much. It's strong borders, better education, better jobs. And I think you're right. We've gotten to a point where the division within Congress has put us in a position to not be doing the best we can for the American people. And if I'm in the minority of that and it costs me some points with the leadership, so be it. But I plan on doing the right thing by the people of the 12th congressional district, regardless of what the party thinks.
You have said that advancing the political interests of the African-American community is a critical aspect of your role as a Black Republican, and that you advocate for policies that, quote, promote economic empowerment, educational opportunities, criminal justice reform, and improved access to health care. Again, is your party on the same page with you on these issues?
I think so. I mean, I've had an opportunity to talk. I was just with our state Senate Majority Leader Paul Newton last night, and I was introducing him to young Black entrepreneurs from across the state. And I think that a big part of this problem is that, and there's an agenda that the media has to be salacious. That sells ads, that sells papers. But when we get down to the brass tacks of it, I've not met one Republican, in whether that's in our legislature or in Congress, that does not want to see the Black community succeed, achieve, and do well, just like they want every other American to do well, succeed, and achieve. But I think that all gets lost in the sauce of having to come up with millions of dollars to please the caucus leaders, you know, having to figure out why once I get elected, I'm already rerunning for election. So I think we need to get focused on those things instead of worrying about whether or not we're going to get reelected. I mean, that's an unpopular opinion, but that's where I land on it.
But that's the system that you will find yourself in should you succeed in this election. And you're one person out of, 435 people in Congress who would be having to swim upstream rapidly to achieve any of these things. And your party has made it a point of saying they want to repeal the Affordable Care Act, which has provided affordable health care to a lot of people who didn't have it prior to that. Where do you stand on that? Is there a better solution than the Affordable Care Act?
Well, at this point, I don't think abolishing, you know, private insurance is the way to go. As one of the presidential candidates said, I think we did the right thing in North Carolina by expanding health care here. I think that working class people, if the government is going to spend money on health care, I think working class people should have affordable, accessible health care, and we should keep our prescription drugs low. I think the difficulty is that there are those in my party who would basically call a social program socialism. And I think that distinction needs to be made that healthcare, everybody has a right to healthcare. Everybody should have access to healthcare. And I think that, you know, given if I'm one person that's swimming against the stream, there may be others in Congress that would say, hey, wait a minute, maybe we can swim collectively together. So I'm in favor of it. And I think that we need to make sure we're shoring up people's access to healthcare.
One of your concerns is upward mobility, and that is certainly a concern among a lot of people in Charlotte, both rank and file voters, but also civic leaders in Charlotte have been concerned about it. How would you work toward those ends as a member of Congress?
So look, I'm not under the impression that a freshman congressman is going to get up to DC and change what's happening in DC, but I can certainly impact what's happening here in my district. And I think one of the most important things we can do is get people connected to the skills that will allow them to improve their work conditions, whether that's project management, IT, things of that nature. I'm actually proposing something called the More Americans in Technology Act, which would set aside a portion of funding to support at a middle school level, getting our kids more engaged in technology careers. The other thing I think we need to look at is bringing back the trades. We need carpenters, we need plumbers, we need pipe fitters. These are people that do very well. I just had to have an electrician come to the house, and I was like, you make really good money. So I think we've got to bring back the decency. Matter of fact, Mike, real quick, I just saw on a Facebook post, it was nothing to do with politics, it was something to do with an actress. And somebody berated somebody that was, they said, what do you clean bathrooms or cut meat for a living? As if those are, it's a derogatory that you would do what you need to do to feed your family. And as a matter of fact, I am a big fan of ensuring that working people, everyday people can do better. So I think we've got to bring decency back, respect back to our trades. We get our young people connected at an early age to the jobs that are coming to Charlotte. And last but not least on this subject, I had an opportunity yesterday to stand out with the Communication Workers of America, which is not a typical Republican thing to do, is to go out and stand on a picket line with, you know, with labor unions. I think we do need to be looking at what benefit our labor unions can bring to our North Carolina working class system and see how those things pan out.
I got to tell you, the more you talk, the more I think you're a Democrat. These are the jobs you're just talking about, the trades, are jobs that can't be outsourced because they got to come to your house. And most of them cannot be done through artificial intelligence because they're not going to know how to fix a pipe or wire an electric circuit. Let's talk about another problem that faces us all and the need for these workers, in many cases, immigrants. We have a seriously broken immigration system. There's no question about it. And we can argue all day about whether or not Joe Biden has protected the border or whether Donald Trump protected the border or built the wall. But he does advocate for the mass deportation of immigrants. And there is great concern among farmers and other people that if you do that, there'll be no people to pick the fruit and the vegetables. Where do you stand on that? What do we do about this problem?
So first and foremost, my great grandparents immigrated here from Puerto Rico and they did it the right way. And I think it's an affront not only to every American citizen, but to those who want to be American citizens to do it the right way for illegals to come to our country and get benefits. I don't think it's tenable. It's not reality to say we're going to round up every person, undocumented person, and get them out of here. If you're contributing to our country, if you're working hard, you're paying taxes, you're doing what you're supposed to do, I think we ought to be finding a way to get those people legal and get them documented. I'm 1,000% on board with that. But I also think we have a criminal, illegal, alien problem in our country. Think about Lincoln Riley and the others. I was just reading about an apartment complex in Colorado that's been taken over by an illegal alien gang. So I do think we need to round up the criminals, the ones that are not contributing to the fabric of our country, and we need to get them out of here. But I don't think it's a reality. And I would say to anybody that's listening to this show that is an undocumented immigrant and wants to be in this country and contribute, I believe you should stay here. I'd fight for you to stay here. I'd fight for a pathway to citizenship. But if you're a criminal and you're in our country illegally, I would 1,000% support you getting out of here. And one other thing I'll mention, which I thought was a no-brainer, my opponent voted against a bill that would deport illegal aliens that assault police officers. This is a common sense measure. So I think we've got to have a realistic, common sense approach to immigration. I believe in immigration. I believe that's what makes our country great. But if you're a criminal and you're doing violence and you're doing harm, you need to go.
Abdul Ali is running against incumbent Democratic Congresswoman Alma Adams in North Carolina's 12th Congressional District. She appeared on this program on August the 8th, and you can hear what she had to say by downloading the podcast or going to our website at WFAE.org. Abdul Ali, welcome back to the program, and thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you for the opportunity, Mike.
You're welcome. Politics in the news cycle that covers it is on a treadmill running on high. Most people can barely keep up with how fast things are changing, particularly in the race for president. But now both parties have chosen their candidates. Their respective conventions are over, and we have, I'm counting, 68 days until Election Day, with some voting early. Again, begins what? In a couple of weeks here. The change at the top of the Democratic ticket, an attempted assassination of the Republican nominee, very different political conventions, which painted alternative views of where the country is today and where the parties want to take them, are beginning to affect polls, and politicians are reacting. So let's turn again to two journalists whose beat is Capitol Hill to get the latest on how members of Congress are reacting to recent turns of events, including RFK Jr. dropping out of the race and throwing his support to Donald Trump, and how Republican politicians are continuing to stick by Trump, or not. Daniel Battaglia is a congressional correspondent for the Charlotte Observer and the Raleigh News and Observer, and Reuben Jones is back with us. He's the Washington reporter for Spectrum News, covering North Carolina and national politics. Welcome back. Good to see you again.
Thanks for having us.
Morning, Mike.
So, Danielle, the last time you were here, you and Reuben were here, Vice President Harris had just chosen Tim Walz to be her running mate. We talked about the infusion of enthusiasm all of this created. The Democratic convention turned out to be a joy fest, at least for Democrats. Has that filtered down to Democrats that you've spoken with throughout North Carolina in and out of politics, Danielle?
They seem very excited. I think joyful seems to be the word that I would use. I think that honeymoon period is extended still. I've seen a lot of hope in the Democratic Party, a lot of excitement that they can win North Carolina, and that seems to be carrying through past the convention.
And Governor Roy Cooper, our governor, had the lead-in position at the Democratic National Convention. He made the introductory speech for the Democrats' nominee, Kamala Harris. What does that tell you about either Roy Cooper or about the importance of North Carolina to Democrats in November?
Danielle. I think it says a couple different things. North Carolina is definitely at play for Democrats. We've seen that since, I would say, last May of 2023. They've definitely been pushing to make North Carolina one of their focuses to clinch that win for them. They haven't won since 2008, and before that was 1973. So that is something they really want, they're hungry for. And I think part of that was showing North Carolina standing for Democrats and how much they are focused on that. For Governor Cooper, there has been a longstanding friendship between Vice President Kamala Harris and Governor Cooper. They've known each other since they were both attorneys generals of their state. And so I think it was a mix of their friendship and, he was considered to be her vice president. If she had chosen him, he dropped out before that decision could be made. There was that consideration. There is rumors that she could take him into possibly a cabinet position. And so I think it was a mix of both, the friendship, the possibility for more for his career, and also playing North Carolina up.
Coming out of political conventions, Reuben, the candidate of that party usually gets a bump in the polls. I don't know that Donald Trump got a measurable bump, but Kamala Harris seems to have, at least in some of the polls. And in fact, the nonpartisan Cook Political Report has now shifted North Carolina's presidential contest from lean Republican to toss-up, because Harris is narrowing the gap here and in other contested states. Is that because of the convention, do you think, and the honeymoon period that could continue or end when these debates begin, or even tonight when she sits down with Dana Bash on CNN and does her first interview? Is this a long-lasting thing in your mind?
I think the DNC definitely has a role, Mike. I think, though, we've seen really since the second she jumped in, enthusiasm spiked automatically. And so we saw that with not only the Cook Political Report, but the UVA Center for Politics, who really tracks these results closely and projects, put North Carolina from being leans Republican to toss up, which is something that I guess we wouldn't really have been surprised about months ago. We've been talking about North Carolina being a swing state, but a couple months ago, Joe Biden was really struggling in North Carolina. It didn't look like he was going to be able to win. Kamala Harris has flipped that. One of the ways she's done that, Mike, the Cook Political Report cites, is that it's not necessarily that Donald Trump is losing ground. It's that Kamala Harris is bringing back Democrats that Joe Biden had lost. And so she's rallying the Democrats, which is what we saw at the DNC, which she's going to need to continue to do over the next few weeks.
Democrats in North Carolina helped put Obama in the White House back in his time, but they switched their allegiance, it seems to me, or didn't vote, and that led the North Carolina to vote for Trump in the Trump election. Is that what's going to happen again? Is that what we see happening, a trend toward these people coming back like they did for Obama?
Yeah, I mean, you heard Roy Cooper say at a speech when Kamala Harris was down in Raleigh a week or two ago, and he said, I've got that 2008 feeling. And that was the last time North Carolina voted for a Democratic president, which was, of course, Barack Obama. I was down at a rally in Atlanta, one of Kamala Harris's first when she became the running for president. And I will say it had a little bit of that Barack Obama feeling, where you have really high enthusiasm. You've got long lines of people trying to get inside, braving the elements. And that is not exactly the approach that Joe Biden had been taking when he was running for president with large rallies. And it did, obviously, very different dynamics, different conversations. But it did have a little bit of the feel of a Donald Trump rally that we've seen a few over the past years, because he does draw very large crowds at his rallies and very enthusiastic people.
I'm not sure you have time to answer this question, Danielle, but Kamala Harris has been concentrating on Georgia. You just mentioned Atlanta yesterday. She was in southern Georgia, which is not exactly a hotbed of Democratic support. How important is Georgia versus North Carolina? How important is North Carolina versus, say, Pennsylvania or Wisconsin or Michigan or Arizona? And I have 30 seconds.
I've heard them say that you need to win North Carolina to win the presidential election. So I don't know that I could answer that in 30 seconds, but they think it's important.
Well, if you think you can answer it in a longer amount of time, I'll come back to you and we can do it then. Okay, you're saying yes. We'll do that when we come back and touch on some other things of interest as we head toward Election Day here in North Carolina and around the country. We're here with Danielle Battaglia, congressional correspondent of the Charlotte Observer and the Raleigh News and Observer, and Reuben Jones with Spectrum News. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. The Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Danielle Battaglia from the Charlotte Observer and the News and Observer in Raleigh, and Reuben Jones from Spectrum News, who reports on all things politics and Washington and North Carolina from Washington for Spectrum. Let me go back to that question about which state is more important and where we fit in the panoply of important states in this presidential election cycle, Danielle. Are we more important than Georgia, where Kamala Harris spent much of yesterday? Are we as important as some of the other blue wall states, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan, as important as Arizona, Nevada, et cetera?
You know, we're one of the seven battleground states, and every Democrat that I talk to says the path to the White House runs through North Carolina. I focus on North Carolina, so I can tell you the North Carolina perspective on this, and that is that path runs through North Carolina. There are other states. There's a lot of different charts showing, like, this state and this state gives you this many electoral counts, and so there's a lot of people smarter than me that can give you the math on it. But our politicians like to tell you that you do need North Carolina to win. And Ruben, who is one of those people smarter than me, looks like he has thoughts on this.
Go ahead, Ruben.
I would never claim to be smarter than Danielle Bataille,
but
I will say that North Carolina is a state where Democrats are playing offense. It's the only state of the battleground states where they did not win in 2020. So it's a state where they can, you know, they'd love to win. Do they necessarily need it? Not necessarily. But if they do win it on election night, there's a good chance that Kamala Harris has won the presidency.
You know, we all watched most of us, I'm sure everybody on Capitol Hill watched the conventions, both of the conventions, and they're certainly aware of what's going on with polling around the country. Ruben, I'm just curious how they feel about how this is going. What is the undercurrent? Are they worried? Are they pleased? I guess it depends on which side of the aisle you're on, but what is the prevailing sentiment?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's definitely increased optimism just based on what the polls are showing. I don't think anyone might would have expected what we've seen in the turnaround with the polls. We've not only seen a turnaround with the polls, but Kamala Harris's approval rating has gone up as well, which is very significant. She's doing better among some key voter groups. You look at North Carolina, you know, there's some key groups that she needs to do well in, Black voters, young voters, and things like that. So I think it's surprising. There is, of course, that sense of cautiousness, especially given that one of the next key important dates, yes, tonight with the interview, but more importantly, is September 10th in that debate. Democrats thought Joe Biden was going to do well against Donald Trump. That didn't really pan out for the debate. Mm-hmm. The question, Kamala Harris.
Pundits say that Donald Trump is struggling to find his footing as he runs against Kamala Harris and not Joe Biden. And we understand that his aides allegedly are encouraging to stick to the script and not go off onto the tangents that he's known for. Of course, he can't seem to do that. Former members of the Trump administration, the Trump cabinet, have refused to endorse him. His former vice president, Mike Pence, has refused to endorse him. It seems that a book a week comes out from somebody who worked with him in the previous administration, calling him a danger to the country and to the world. Plus, we witnessed a parade of Republicans speak out against him at the Democratic National Convention. But are they outliers, Danielle? Are most Republicans sticking with Donald Trump?
It seems like they are. I missed half your question because I don't know what happened to my feed to you guys. But from what I've seen, I've not seen Republicans walk away from former President Donald Trump. I've seen, you know, the Republicans in North Carolina that I would expect to walk away faster, I've seen stick by his side. And so I'm not seeing that from our politicians.
It's sometimes really confusing. I just spent 30 minutes being confused with a candidate in the 12th Congressional District about how his desires and his policies jive or don't with the majority of Republicans. And Ruben, you recently spoke with former North Carolina Republican Senator Richard Burr. Richard Burr voted to convict Donald Trump in the second impeachment trial following the January 6th incursion on the Capitol. Yet he told you that he plans to vote for Donald Trump in November. Did he say why?
Yes, I asked him that because I think some people were a little confused about that. They thought, you know, you vote for impeachment, why would you vote for in the election? And for him, his perspective, he felt that voting for impeachment didn't mean you were disqualified to be president. It just meant you made a bad decision at that one time.
But had he voted for impeachment and had the impeachment taken hold, if he had been convicted by the Senate, he would have been disqualified from ever holding office in America again. So I don't understand the logic.
That's correct. He would not have been allowed to run for president. Again, Burr, from his perspective, thinks that this was just a moment in time, a really bad decision. I think he also does not, you know, Richard Burr is a much different Republican than Donald Trump is in the way that he talks, in the way that he approaches politics. He may not agree with Donald Trump's language and approach, but he does agree with him on many of his policies.
So the entire, let's move on to other races, the entire North Carolina delegation, because the entire House of Representatives is up for re-election in November, that we have 68 days to go. And yet, for the most part, The races in this part of North Carolina have been pretty quiet. Am I imagining that, Ruben? And if so, why? Why are we hearing more about these races and these candidates?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of the House races, there's really only one you're going to hear much about, and that's far eastern North Carolina in the 1st District with Democrat Don Davis taking on Republican political newcomer Lori Buckout. I think, Danielle can correct me, I think it's the only swing House race in the South. So it's going to get attention, but that, frankly, that part of the state does not get the attention that it deserves in the national conversation. It will get more, but not as much. On the other state races, governor's race is getting a good amount of attention. One thing that surprised me a little bit, I was talking with someone about this yesterday, is the attorney general's race between Republican Dan Bishop and Democrat Jeff Jackson, who are two sitting members of Congress, which makes this very unusual, and two members that are very outspoken and have significant followings, but it's been pretty quiet so far. I mean, there's been some back and forth, but not a lot of attention. And that could be because the governor's race is sucking some of the attention away, as well as the presidential.
But we don't seem to be getting a lot of attention from them or focus being put on them by their campaigns, Danielle. Jeff Jackson is a TikTok star. I don't follow him on TikTok because I'm not on TikTok, but perhaps he's touting his own horn there. I don't know. Dan Bishop was the most conservative member of the House of Representatives in Congress, and I think also when he was in the State House. They are at odds with each other, at loggerheads. Why aren't we hearing more from them, from their campaigns?
I mean, I would love to know that. I thought going into this election, that would be one that we would see a lot of back and forth. I thought we'd see a lot of spending in that race, and it has been incredibly quiet. You know, we are out of session. I think part of what sometimes brings them out is what's going on in the House that they are going back and forth on. And we are on our August break, which is probably 6 weeks. So, you know.
But it's 68 days till the election.
Yeah.
Okay.
I can't explain them.
Mike, one thing that's interesting, and I don't like, I don't give a lot of attention to polls because I find a lot of flaws in them. But if you look at the governor's race poll, I mean, Mark Robinson is really struggling against Josh Stein. Stein is starting to pull away. But if you look at the down ballot races, like the race for attorney general, it's neck and neck. It's very close. So these candidates do need to talk. They do need to get out there. I think we'll probably see one or two debates over the next few months. That's one way, but they got to get on the airwaves and they got to get out there.
And we are beginning to see political commercials for and against Josh Stein and Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson, who are running against each other for governor. I mean, you just mentioned, Ruben, that the polls show Josh Stein pulling ahead. Do we understand why? What's at work there?
Yeah, I mean, I think that Mark Robinson, Josh Stein's campaign has been able to really brand Mark Robinson as someone that won't appeal to not only Democrats, but also independent voters and some moderate Republican voters. So they've spent a lot of money, around $15 million compared to Mark Robinson, who spent about $5 million on the TV. So they've been able to do that. Robinson's gotten quite a bit of negative press that I'm sure has not helped as well. And one area where Robinson is struggling is among non-college educated women who have shifted from supporting Robinson to now supporting Stein.
The first survey by the Elon University poll for North Carolina's fall election found a high level of concern among voters about the integrity of this year's vote count and the potential violence that might follow this election. The poll shows that only 48% of the state's voters have confidence in the national vote count to be fair and accurate. That's down from 69% just 4 years ago. Distrust in our elections, of course, being encouraged by Donald Trump and other Republicans with no evidence to back it up. Does anyone that you have spoken with, Ruben or Danielle, Democrat or Republican, have any ideas on how to stop the decline in trust or to reverse it? Is that a topic of conversation? I'll start with you, Ruben.
I mean, I think, Danielle, correct me on this, but I think there is a group of political experts, again, correct me on this, but Michael Bitzer, Chris Cooper, Bob Orr, who are on a kind of a blitz around the state to talk about some of these issues and let people know the fact versus fiction. And so I think part of this is conversation and it's dialogue. But sure, there is definitely going to be concern going into this election about a lot of the distrust that is still out there. We've got the anniversary of January 6th coming up. There's going to be concern about what might happen then and the presidential transition on whoever it may be. So there's definitely concern out there. And the hope, I think, is that we can get some of the more facts out there.
Is there conversation, Danielle, in your experience among politicians who are concerned about the lack of trust in our elections? Because you can't have a democracy if nobody believes the outcome.
I feel like the politicians are part of problem, which feels very harsh to say, but you know, when you're listening to the rhetoric that's going on right now, the ones that are casting doubt on the election are the politicians themselves. And so those are the loudest voices in the room and also the people with power. And so I think those are the ones that are being amplified. And so when people like Michael Bitzer and Chris Cooper try to tour the state and say, this is the facts about the election, those voices aren't being lifted up as loudly as the voices that are telling you that the election is not secure.
Michael Bitzer and Chris Cooper are both political scientists. Michael from Catawba College, Cooper from Western Carolina. Bob Orr is a Republican and a former justice, Supreme Court justice in the state Supreme Court. He's been traveling with other members of an organization, I've forgotten the name of it now, but it's associated with the Carter Center, to hold seminars throughout the state. And we had him on the program to talk to voters about their concerns and assure them, not only educate them how the election system works, but assure them that it's fair and accurate, and here's why. And I asked him, who are you talking to? Who's coming to these events? Are you preaching to the choir? And isn't that part of the problem? If you're an election denier, or you're a conspiracy theorist, or you've bought into the idea that our elections are rigged, are you going to come to these events? That's an open-ended question.
Yeah, I mean, that's the question is, how do you reach people that may not necessarily attend one of those events? You do it over, I would think part of the way of doing that, and I don't know if they've got funding for this, is to do it over television ads, radio ads, and things like that. Or maybe even more importantly, I would never say don't do ads on mainstream platforms, but social media is where a lot of this information comes from.
Then you have to remember too, sorry, go ahead.
It's okay, no, go ahead.
I was going to say they're up against a network that's also operating in North Carolina with some of Trump's attorneys that were preaching the election fraud, that are also going around saying that there is election fraud. Yeah. And so, you know, they're battling it out in our state.
Well, they're liars. So some of the distrust of our voting process was the focus of attention the last election cycle, and early voting begins October the 17th. Early voting is one of the things that people were distrustful of. It begins October 17th in our state, October 23rd in South Carolina. And Ruben, you recently reported on something having to do with early voting and something that happens after you early vote that I never considered. What happens if you vote early and then you die? Does does your vote count? Does it?
It's a good question. I frankly had never thought about until one of our producers started digging into it. And it depends on the state. There are differing laws. So basically what this, we were thinking about this because of Jimmy Carter, who, you know, has just done a remarkable job of staying strong during hospice care for over a year now. And he has said, I want to vote early. Even if I pass away before the election happens, I want to vote early. And so the question is that allowed? And it really does depend on the state. And I am forgetting at this moment, Mike, so I hope you have it in front of you, about North Carolina. I'm pretty sure that North Carolina does allow, but correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah, but I don't know how they would enforce it. I don't know how they would find it out. Danielle, you want to shed some light on that?
There is an actual famous case from a couple years ago. I want to say it was 2020, where Brunswick County Board of Elections Director Sarah Knott's mother died of brain cancer during the election. She had already cast her ballot, and she made the decision to contest her mother's vote, knowing that it would be pulled out after canvassing. And so she went ahead and did it well before they had counted it as a vote. And it was really difficult for her. But North Carolina is a state that does not have laws on the book about it. I'm pretty sure I read in Rubin's reporting.
We only have a minute left. Kamala Harris is speaking to Dana Bash at CNN tonight at 9 o'clock. It's her first sit-down. She's bringing along Tim Walz, and Republicans have chided Kamala Harris for not holding any reporter interviews. This is it. So, what's at stake here? What does she have to do not to lose? Danielle.
That's a heavy-handed question. They're going back to where President Biden famously had a problem with his debate. So I'm really interested to see how they handle this, and can she deliver what the people want to see from her, both with policy and her personal questions?
Danielle Battaglia is a congressional correspondent for the Charlotte Observer and the Raleigh News and Observer, and Reuben Jones is the Washington reporter reporting on North Carolina and politics from Capitol Hill for Spectrum News.
Celebrating 25 years on the air, Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.